Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. For years now, there's been a great deal of concern about a particular government organization, namely the United States Commission for International Religious Freedom, USIRF. One would probably intuit that because religious freedom is held in such high regard by our Constitution, that people from a wide range of political and spiritual platforms would support such an effort. But in recent times, it has come under significant criticism. If you were to learn that some of that detraction was due to the charge on one side, or by one side, that the Commission paid an inordinate amount of attention to the persecution of Christians abroad, to the expense of others, I doubt you'd be surprised. But it has also faced disapproval because of its seeming support of radical Islamist regimes. You might wonder how that squares. The move to disband USIRF is growing, and one opponent is Dr. Mark Silk. We had Dr. Silk on our program a while back to discuss the role of religion in the 2018 midterm elections, and we're happy to have him back today to analyze USIRF. A little bit about our guest. Mark Silk received degrees from Harvard, including his PhD in medieval history. Then he joined its faculty. He then became editor of the Boston Review and later on the staff of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, where he worked variously as a reporter, editorial writer, and columnist. In 1996, he became the first director of the Leonard E. Greenberg Center for the Study of Religion in Public Life, and in 1998, the founding editor of Religion in the News, a magazine published by the center that examines how the media handle religious subject matter. In 2005, he was also named director of the Trinity College Program on Public Values in Hartford, Connecticut, comprising both the Greenberg Center and a new institute for the study of secularism in society and culture. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, Dr. Mark Silk. Hello, Mark.
Hello, I'm delighted to be here, Fred.
Thank you. Hey, before we get to USIRF, a couple of questions about your role as someone who studies the media. Would you agree that there has been an evolution, a positive growth over the last couple of decades in terms of how religion is covered and how many reporters and columnists and other media observers are a little bit more religion literate?
Well, I would have agreed, a while back, the news media have been in such turmoil over the past two decades that it's a little hard to say that in any clear way. There was certainly a real increase in attention and in number of reporters and the amount of news space given to religion in the early and mid 1990s, which is already quite a while ago, and part of it was really driven by newspaper anxiety, not about profits, which were very large. It's hard to imagine that, but back then, but decline in readership. As always, newspaper people, journalists are interested in politics and the role of religion in politics helped spur that. With the collapse of newspapers has also come the kind of just collapse of specialty beats of all sorts, science reporters and education reporters and so on. And so the cadre of full-time newspaper reporters, and that was always the largest one of religion writers, has really shrunk dramatically. But there is lots of coverage on the other, from a variety of sources. Very often these include people who are not traditional journalists, who are not reporting the way traditional journalists do, sort of in an even-handed way. But, there's tons of religion online, just as there's tons of politics and so on. A lot of it is much more partisan or focused than it used to be. But, I think if you're interested in sort of going online and becoming religiously literate, now is a better time than 20 years ago. So I would give a Scotch verdict on that one.
Well taken. I just remember back in the 70s when Jimmy Carter became president, people, it seemed like
reporters and media pundits just didn't really quite know what an evangelical Christian was. And I think we've grown a little bit from there.
Yeah, we certainly have. Those were the born-agains, as they were called at the time.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I don't know how many columns I've read and how many talking heads I've seen on TV or heard on radio that still seem so mystified about the evangelical Pentecostal support for Trump. And it's like, dude, that has been settled. He's giving them what they want. Case closed, am I right?
Yeah, I think that's essentially right. It's beyond that. This is a block of citizens that by the time Trump came along had been locked into the Republican Party. So whether he gave him what they wanted, or some of what they wanted, or a bit of what they wanted, I think you'd still see 4 out of 5 white evangelicals voting for the Republican, for Trump. But he has certainly ratcheted up their enthusiasm by giving them what they want, and whether it's Supreme Court justices or certain kinds of real or symbolic acts of the administration. As probably the least religious president maybe we've ever had.
And not to mention that you look at past Republican presidents such as Reagan and the two Bushes, nobody has ever attained an almost prophetic halo about them, that there is in fact a group of people who truly believe he is sent by God. That's what I find fascinating, and I don't think I've ever seen that in any other president's rhetoric. But then, of course, he encourages that sort of thinking, so it's pretty obvious.
It came a little close at moments with George W. Bush. There was a famous a documentary of something called Jesus Camp, I think that was the name of the documentary, in which you had little kids sort of praying in front of a cardboard cutout of George W. Bush, which seemed to emblemize a certain degree of that kind of enthusiasm. But I totally agree with you. There's not the kind of almost apocalyptic adoration or connection to Donald Trump is unprecedented.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get to today's subject, which is kind of sort of connected to what we've been talking about the last few minutes, the United States Commission for Religious Freedom. Tell us a little bit of its history. How did it develop?
Well, I'm actually pretty up on this because by a set of circumstances, back when it was first created in 1998, we hosted a conference that included the key people in sort of setting it up and I have a pretty good story here, and if you want to entertain it, I can tell the story. But
by
it really
means.
Originated in the 1990s as a kind of as part of an effort to embarrass the Clinton administration and Bill Clinton by some of the sort of anti-Clinton conservatives, I'm not sure that they were particularly the evangelicals, but more neoconservative types, and they thought that Clinton was vulnerable to the charge that he wasn't doing enough about protecting religious liberty abroad or doing something to on behalf of persecuted minorities, probably particularly Christians, but they thought they had an opening there. And so they advanced a bill which would have sort of created, various instruments of government to sort of pursue that. In fact, it was a false charge, and in many ways, the way religious liberty issues, which often came down to individual people, you know, efforts to kind of do some protection. It tended to be handled on a, in a private way. The key person was then-Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana on the Republican side, Senator Ted Kennedy on the Democratic side, and whatever administration was in office, the Clinton administration in this case, and frequently there would be sort of behind the scenes efforts to get some protection from, you know, somebody who'd been thrown in jail or that kind of thing. And the key staffer for Lugar at that time was a guy named John Hanford, actually a relative, I think a cousin of Elizabeth Dole, Elizabeth Hanford Dole, if you'll remember her full name. And John Hanford saw this piece of legislation coming along. He was working, you know, he's a Republican working for a Republican senator, but he thought it was a bad thing, and basically contrived to sort of make it less bad in a variety of ways.
Well, can you tell us? Can you tell us why he thought it was bad?
Well, he didn't think it was necessary. He thought that the basic charge against the Clinton administration was wrong. It was not a fair accusation. And he thought that there were, you know, that there might be some good that it could be done. It could be done by doing it in the right way. I think they changed some of the language, and I don't know. I'd have to review it. Now goes back over 20 years, but they sort of seized control of the process and put into effect a system which included provisions for advice and counsel to the Senate. To the Secretary of State on religious liberty issues and a bunch of other stuff. And in some ways, it was okay. It was still, even at that time, not without criticism, principally because there were people who felt like, you know, why is it the business of the United States to take it upon itself to sort of determine religious liberty around the world? And some of this is based on simply a recognition that what counted as religious liberty in the United States, what counts, you know, under the First Amendment, you know, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's religious liberty in our terms. But there are states that are perfectly decent that have established churches, and you know, then there are other ones which see themselves as really privileging a particular religion in a way that is not necessarily religious persecution of others, although you could see it that way. But it gets into a very complicated area, which is not covered the way human rights is by a protocol signed by lots of countries. Although, you know, there is language in the human rights documents on religious liberty, but a feeling that, you know, the United States was through this arrogating to itself a kind of authority over religion that it shouldn't have. But it did pass. It was signed into law by Clinton. And the only thing that really was sort of the Empire Strikes Back moment in this whole episode was that at the last minute, as I recall, a bunch of funding was put in place for this commission, and which really set it up as a kind of permanent body, as opposed to, I think, what was originally conceived, which was in a sort of advisory role, that you had a bunch of advisors who could talk to the State Department or whatever. State Department was given the authority to write a report annually on the state of religious freedom around the world. But now, thanks to the funding, which was, you know, several million dollars a year, this commission, instead of being merely advisory, a bunch of people who are concerned about this issue who might be brought in to give advice to the administration and Congress, now is a separate agency with its own staff and a kind of an independent government-funded institution with members appointed by both Democrats and Republicans, or, you know, administration, you know, that various people like that. Nine commissioners. And all of a sudden, what then happened, then once the bill became law and went into effect, is you had this somewhat odd independent entity organization, government-funded, government agency, which took it upon itself to issue its own annual report on the state of religious liberty around the world, and, you know, country by country. And in many of these cases, taking a different view than the State Department, and also issuing various kinds of warnings, criticisms, occasional praise for actions taken by the administration, by Congress, and then, of course, behavior by international bodies. So if you're some country out there, here's this independent entity which has no power, which is not Congress or the administration, which has a whole panoply of sort of foreign aid funding and other kinds of inducements or promises that it can give, but simply this sort of freelancing organization that now, in the name of the federal government, because it's part of the federal government, could go around saying, you Myanmar are behaving badly with the Rohingya, or you Russia are behaving badly with the Jehovah's Witnesses, or whatever. And from the standpoint of those countries, that's annoying. Maybe they deserved it. Certainly, the two cases I've mentioned, they would deserve it. But who are these people? What power do they have? Do we talk to them? What about the people we talk to in Congress? There's a kind of redundancy there, and a freedom to do whatever they wanted that I think has been over the years somewhat problematic. There's a case to be made for having an independent voice, criticizing, say, Saudi Arabia when American administrations, Democratic as well as Republican, cozy up to the Saudis, despite their, sort of hideous record on religious tolerance, liberty. But that's a somewhat long-winded version of how we got to where we are.
No, it's very.
It's more of the story than that.
Oh, certainly, and we'll get into that piece by piece. I want to just mention that if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella. My guest is Dr. Mark Silk, and we are talking about the United States Commission for Religious Freedom. So how did all of this end up occasionally, I believe, if I'm reading this correctly, promote more radical Islamist governments around the world?
I'm not sure exactly what, to tell you the truth, Fred, I'm not sure exactly how that works. That is to say, I mean, I'm revealing my ignorance here, but I think it's better than pretending to know things. To the extent tell me what you know, and I'll respond.
Yeah, I was doing some research, and it seemed to indicate that you serve because of the rules and regs, because of the way they rank things. Because the way they rank behaviors, etc., that they ended up giving higher ranks to some Islamist countries than they did countries that you and I would think. Now, wait a minute here. How could Saudi Arabia or how could Yemen outrank another country that we'd look at? Wait a minute here. Well, I've never heard about people, being thrown into prison just for being a Christian or a Jew or something like that. Mm-hmm. I'll give you for instance, I know that I've spoken to a few Indian Americans who are very frustrated with USERF because traditionally they have given them lower marks than some of the countries that you would be surprised. Mm-hmm. And I think that for the most part, although, yes, there is certainly conflict in India, by and large, historically, people from a variety of religions have thrived there for centuries upon centuries. And again, especially right now as we are speaking, there's a significant amount of communal violence over a proposed law. But nonetheless,
no, the law actually is passed, and I think.
Oh yes, it's going for review, I think, in the courts. I could mm-hmm. be wrong about that,
but there is. Yeah, I think there's very legitimate reason to be concerned about the sort of you know, Hindu nationalism of the current Prime Minister, Prime Minister Modi, and the threat that poses to this, you know, the sort of even-handed approach that the Indian state has taken from the outset. But look, I think there's always going to be complaints, and you know how you surf. I don't know the answer to the question of what their, you know, how their criteria could end up privileging. I'm not questioning it. What you have to say, certain countries. They, over the years, Yusuf has been critical of the Saudis in Saudi Arabia specifically for its behavior and at times when, you know, administrations have been reluctant to call out the Saudis. If you like that kind of thing, it's certainly fair enough to have done it. There may be other bad examples. I mean, there may be bad examples out there, as you say. And you know, whenever you're engaged in this kind of an exercise, first of all, whoever's criticized is going to be unhappy. And then there are reasons to think, you know, well, what we're doing is not unreasonable. I mean, you know, part of the complaints of the Indians at the moment is that, I mean, you know, the Modi's law has to do with Muslim immigration. And if you've got a president who's talking about, you know, of the United States, the head of this administration, who's talked about Muslim bans and put in place restrictions on immigration from predominantly Muslim countries, you say, you know, where does this entity come off criticizing us? And so, yeah, I mean, this is one of the problems of the whole exercise.
Right. And just to put a point on it, what I've heard, the frustration from certain people who from India is that, wait a minute here, this law encourages refugees from specifically three countries, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Afghanistan, which are Muslim majority countries. So, you know, since you're probably not going to be persecuted unless you're some minority heretical sect, the people coming from those countries into India would not be Muslim. If they're, you know, they could be persecuted for something else, but not from their Islamic beliefs. You know what I'm saying? Then wait a minute here. If you're criticizing India for not including Muslims in that list of religions, why aren't you criticizing those three countries that are forcing minorities to leave? You see what I'm saying? That's what the criticism I've heard.
Yeah, look, I think these are, first, I mean, there are all kinds of challenges in really getting to the bottom of any set of policies, complicated policies put in place by a country. And, you know, an entity with a small staff, which is what USURF has, you know, is dependent on, you know, a variety of sources, outside staff and so on. You know, I think one has to be very, very careful and judicious in you know, how one approaches these things and issuing press statements, which USURF loves to do, condemning this and condemning that. You know, I do know Indians, you know, Hindus, students of mine, who, you know, are very opposed to the nationalities law, and have demonstrated in the streets against it. So, I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, I think it's a good law, or it's been deeply misunderstood, or USURF is misbehaving in doing it. I think the larger problem with USURF is sort of structural. What is it doing, duplicating efforts? And you know, if we've got nonprofit organizations like, you know, Human Rights Watch or other ones that are separate from the government that do these kinds of this kind of scrutiny, you know, what are we really doing here with with a separate organization. I should say, just to be clear, Fred, that, you know, I mean, there are people who are, you know, much more hostile to USERF than I am. I come down, on the side of thinking they should go away. But it's not like I think this is the very worst thing in the world. And from time to time, and we can get into this, I think they have behaved in a, I mean, they've been even-handed. There's been, strong efforts, and including relatively recently and during the Trump administration with leadership, to sort of be concerned about religious minorities, including Muslims, around the world. And I think to have an agency of, even if it's independent of the federal government at the time of the Trump administration doing this, where you've got members of the commission who are leading evangelical supporters of the president and being put in a position as they have, and they've taken this position of protesting against mistreatment of Muslims. I mean, there's something I think useful and good about that. So I just want to be clear that among the people who want to put this entity out of its misery or, jettison it entirely.
You're not a zealot. And perhaps we can talk about that next week, Mark, because we're out of time for this week's show. But we do want you back next time, and we'll continue.
Terrific.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Today we were speaking with Dr. Mark Silk, and today we were talking about the United States Commission for Religious Freedom. Please join us again next week here on WGVU.